Welcome to the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast, where we take information from the highest level of sport and make it accessible for all cyclists. I'm your host, Zach Morris, and in this episode, I sit down with our head coach at Team EF Coaching, Colby Pierce. Colby had a great career as a cyclist, was an Olympian in 2004, won the bronze medal at the Pan American Games. He's a 14-time national track champion, former U.S. hour record holder, and current U.S. 10-kilometer record holder on the track. Colby has so much experience from his racing career, but has a tremendous amount of experience and knowledge coaching other people. Colby approaches coaching from a very unique perspective, and in this episode of the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast, we have a conversation that hosts so much valuable information for cyclists out there looking to improve and be healthier overall. So sit down and enjoy this episode. Colby Pierce, we are so excited to have you on the Team EF Coaching Podcast. You play a big role in this company. As the head coach, you're an asset to the team. You have one of the best minds in cycling. So welcome to the show, Colby.
Thanks for having me on, Zach. I'm excited.
Over in Boulder, are you?
Yes. It's September as of the time of this recording in Boulder, and it is unseasonably warm today still here. So still got some summer vibes going.
So I hear in Boulder, it's either snowing or really hot. And it could happen both in the same week.
Sometimes it can happen within 5 minutes of each other. Yeah. Wow. Boulder's pretty famous for the unpredictable weather. The rule is if you're riding up to Peachy Peak Highway, which is kind of our local big climb, sort of you can do a bunch of loops up there. It's like this highway in the mountains. It's anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 meters in elevation. It doesn't matter what the forecast is. Doesn't matter what month it is. You always bring a rain jacket because you never know what's coming up there.
How many rain jackets do you own?
Probably 5 or 6.
All right. Now, before we go any further, Colby, I've got to hit you with the speed round. The speed round is where I'm going to ask you a series of questions. This is a rapid fire format. You've got 3 seconds to give me a complete answer. No exceptions. You ready?
3 seconds. All right. The pressure's on. Let's do it.
Question number one, favorite color?
Purple.
Squats or deadlifts?
Deadlifts.
Favorite pre-race meal?
Rice and eggs with sea salt, a little bit of cheese.
Singular most important piece of kit to improve performance?
Shoes.
Favorite interval of all time?
Tabatas.
Steak, chicken, fish, or vegan?
Steak.
Favorite road to ride all time?
Probably Left Hand Canyon in Boulder, Colorado.
Favorite rider of all time?
Gianni Bugno.
Do you love your job?
Yes, absolutely.
That's it. Awesome. Thanks so much for taking part of the speed round, Colby. You crushed it.
Cool. Yeah.
So, Colby, you have a lot of different moving parts of your life. You're the head coach at Team EF Coaching. You have a bike fitting studio in Boulder. You're very passionate about strength and conditioning, off-bike training. Give us a little bit of a background on the things you got going on in your life right now.
Yeah, that's a pretty good synopsis. I've been racing bikes for 35 plus years. Was a pro for 15 years in the U.S. on the road, raced on the track. Done quite a bit of mountain bike and cyclocross racing as well. And now, of course, just like a lot of people, I've kind of transitioned into some gravel stuff. So I'm trained with Steve Hogg in Sydney, Australia as a bike fitter back in 2012. And learned an immense amount from him. I did an apartment in Sydney for almost a month to train with Steve. And that was a pretty rigorous session. And then I've had a lot of continuing education courses after that, studying with the Czech Institute in Encinitas, California. That's Paul Czech's school. Studying with him as well and learning more about physiology and holistic coaching. So.
And so how does this all tie into what you do every day as a cycling coach?
Well, ultimately, coaching, you know, as much as it is on a daily or granular level about telling a rider what to do, or rather I say making workout suggestions for an athlete based on their goals. It's also about zooming out and seeing the big picture, you know, making sure we see the forest for the trees, understanding the athlete from a holistic perspective, because athletic performance is not simply tied to what your FTP is or how many watts you're doing during an interval or even how many hours a week you're riding. It's also intimately connected to and related to your total life stress. So we have to take that into consideration. So the deeper I get into coaching with athletes, the more I understand that I have to see the big picture in the coach, in the athlete's life. I have to understand their life stress. What job do they do? What is their relationship status? Is their relationship healthy or not? What's their global health status? What health challenges do they have? How do they present to me physiologically? Not just their VO2 or VLA max, but also, you know, what are their limitations physically? What's their injury history? How flexible are they or aren't they, right? What kind of body type do they have? Are they dominant? You know, is their movement strategy dominantly one of fast twitch fibers, or does it get more into slow twitch? And that's just a few things. It kind of never ends how deep you can go when you learn more about an athlete. The more intimate your knowledge is of an athlete's total life, the better job you can do coaching them.
Yeah, it's almost like you've managed to figure out how to become an expert in all these different areas to specialize in one particular thing. And by understanding all of the variables and all the life factors and off-bike stuff, you're able to help people become much better cyclists. And that's pretty amazing way to look at it. I think that it's pretty rare. When we see a lot of, you know, performance coaches, so much of it can just be about performance. And one of my favorite things about your way of thinking is it's much more about alignment. And when you're healthy mentally and physically, you're able to do things better. And I'm sure you see that a lot in your day-to-day life as a bike fitter. You're known around the world as one of the top fitters, and you probably see people come through your door every single day with all kinds of imbalances and pains. And I mean, what's the reason you go and get a bike fit, right? So you got something that's bothering you, your back's hurting, your knees are hurting, something's not right, right? And so it's your job in a very short period of time. What do your fits normally take, 3, 4, or 5 hours?
Yeah, a typical fit would be 4 to 5 hours for a first-time client where we're doing all the things.
So you've got to take this person, and I mean, when we think about it, it's a pretty short period of time, 3, 4, 5 hours, right? For some, it's a lot, but in the spectrum of life, it's quite a short period of time for you to take somebody and figure out all of these different imbalances that are going on. And if somebody comes in, you know, with knee pain, you're probably looking at like, okay, this is a referral pain issue. The knee pain might be coming from an imbalance in your foot or a tight hip flexor, tight IT band. Like, it might not even be coming from the knee. So what is your process actually look like in understanding these different problems that people come through your door with?
Good question. So I start with a questionnaire that I send my clients in advance. Once they book the fit appointment, I send them a pretty extensive questionnaire. It's 66 questions currently, and it's broken down into different categories. But really, a lot of it zeroes in on what they're experiencing on the bike. If they're having pain or discomfort, I kind of try to really pick apart the nuance of what that pain or discomfort is. You know, what's the onset? Does it come every time they ride, or only after in the second half of a ride, in a certain type of riding, with intensity, without intensity, et cetera? And I really zero in on that. It can be, like you said, anything from foot pain, knee pain, back pain, neck and shoulder pain. These are all commonly reported scenarios. And that gives me the initial sort of platform from which to frame the pre-fit assessment. And so then when I see my athlete, we kind of review some of those questions, and I make sure I have a good understanding of what their experience is. And sometimes we can sort of deduce that the pain is being spun up or exacerbated by their cycling habits. Sometimes the pain seems to be pre-existing and the cycling is not helping it, but not making it worse. Occasionally we have stuff that are aches and pains that get better when they ride, right? Or sometimes we have pain that just sort of seems to be all over the place. We can't really figure out if there's a correlation there. But then I put them through a movement screen, and I look at their mobility, their flexibility. I also just watch them move. I have them do really basic movements like body weight lunges, body weight squats. I have them do a deep squat. I have them do a deadlift with a light weight. And the reason I picked those movements in particular are those are movement archetypes that are expressed in cycling. Cycling is really a static hip hinge with a series of lunges. That's fundamentally what most of cycling is, right? There's a little bit of pulling on the bars. There's a little bit of pushing on the bars, the tiniest bit of rotation in the torso, but really mostly it's lunges from a static hip hinge. So I make sure and zero in on that pattern. And ideally what I like to see are athletes who can achieve what I would call primal standard. Primal standard means you can sort of make the archetype of that movement under body weight and it's pretty much perfect. And I sort of, in my mind, I sort of place them on a spectrum. How close are they to primal standard? How far away are they from primal standard? And if they're pretty far from primal standard in a lunge, then I know we've got some work to do, right? If they're really unstable in their ankles and feet, if they're having trouble being lunging forward on that one leg and their pelvis is having trouble being stable, it's dumping a lot or twisting, there's a lot of rotation, not a lot of control, that tells me quite a bit about their core control, which then tells me a little bit about their breathing patterns. So pretty quickly, we can sort of chase this rabbit into a bunch of holes. And the rabbit's den is very complex, and there's a lot of places we can go. So that becomes the challenging part and that's where experience plays a role in me trying to discern which assessments are going to serve the client and give us valuable information versus which assessments are going to just be ticking off boxes to gain more data about the client, but maybe won't help us towards our goal. And that is an ongoing process for me to continue to refine that. It's a big challenge.
So for anybody that didn't pick that up, can you please explain what a static lunge is?
Sure. A static lunge, an isometric lunge versus a dynamic lunge. Normally I would have people do a dynamic lunge, which is a lunge with movement, right? Meaning you're going to start from a standing position, step forward with one leg, lunge into the lunge position, and then return to standing. That would be an example of a dynamic lunge. A static or isometric lunge would be you would step forward into that lunge and then hold it for a given duration of time. Could be whatever time we decide is useful. 5 seconds, could be 5 minutes. And those can both tell us different things about the athlete.
So even though there's movement in the pedal stroke, you consider the pedal stroke to be a static hip hinge?
I consider the pedal stroke to be a static hip hinge, yes, because the cyclist is in the hinged position when they're riding a bike. Yeah, they're in flexion, they're in hip flexion. Even when the leg is at bottom dead center, there's still a significant amount of hip flexion. This is why when you watch someone do a deadlift, cyclist do a deadlift, or even watch a cyclist run, a lot of times they're sort of almost stuck in hip flexion. They're just sort of used to having flexion at the hip. So I keep saying that term, but let me make sure everybody understands what I mean. Flexion in this respect, we can think of it as movement towards the fetal position. So it would be bending your torso forward, simply put, right?
Curling up into a ball.
Yep. Yep. And so when you're cycling, you are in flexion. You are bent forward at the hips. Now, how well someone achieves that primal standard depends a lot on the flexibility of, for example, their posterior chain. If somebody tries to bend at the hips, hinge at the hips, ideally what we would have is an axis of rotation that would travel right through the center of their hips, meaning right where the femoral head is, right? Through the center. But most people, when they hinge at the hip, they actually keep their sacrum more closer to vertical. And then they flex in the lumbar or thoracic spine. So their spine bends instead of rolling forward at the hips. If you think of your pelvis like a bowl of soup, when we hinge properly at the hip, we would tip our pelvis forward so that the soup would pour out on our toes. But when someone doesn't have a great hip hinge ability, when their hamstrings, for example, are really, really tight, then when they try to rotate forward, their pelvis can't rotate forward because the hamstrings are locking the pelvis in place. So instead, in order to get to those handlebars, they have to flex their spine. And this tends to turn into what I call Ichabod crane posture, which is a common way or a colloquial way for me to say upper cross syndrome, right?
You see so many different problems from the feet to the
top of the head, everything's connected, everything needs to be in alignment to be comfortable and efficient on the bike. You and I have had a lot of conversations recently about some limiting factors from a physiology standpoint and really a neglect to do a lot of corrective work. And you're really passionate about this one particular topic. You brought it up to me several times. Colby, can you explain to the listeners what upper cross syndrome is and why cyclists should know about it?
Yeah. The simple way to think about upper cross syndrome is what I call Ichabod crane posture. I think most people will know what I mean when I say that. Think of this old man or woman who's sort of hunched over. Their shoulders are collapsed forward towards their chest. That's a protracted shoulder. The angle of the first rib, which is the highest rib on your chest, just below your collarbones, has been tipped forward. And that means the upper back, the thoracic spine, is rounded into flexion. So instead of standing upright with the chest sort of in a proper posture, everything in the front side of the chest is collapsed, and then the back side of the chest is long. And then at the same time, the chin will protrude out over the body, so the center of the head is not supported over the skeleton. It's not stacked over the skeleton. Imagine viewing someone from the side. You would see the center of the ear be stacked over their torso. But when someone has forward head posture or upper cross syndrome, the head comes out forward over the torso. And this extends the neck and it lifts the chin. Even though the face may remain in, we'll say, a vertical orientation, the chin starts to become lifted away from the voice box. So these are the fundamental concepts that make up upper cross syndrome: forward head posture, rounded forward oriented shoulders, and a rounded upper back, a thoracic spine. These are basically the fundamental tenets of upper cross syndrome. And syndrome is a word that is used in the corrective exercise field. Really, a syndrome is just a list of things, a list of characteristics that point towards a disease or a dysfunction. We have to be a little careful in using this language directly with a client, because when people hear syndrome, they kind of tend to think that that's a pretty severe term. And sometimes it can lead to a client sort of labeling themselves internally, saying, oh, I have a syndrome, right? And labels aren't always constructive, right? So I wouldn't normally tell a client like, hey man, you've got upper cross syndrome. First of all, I'd be very careful about my language. I would say you are currently displaying some characteristics of upper cross. And I may or may not use the actual word syndrome depending on the context of the client and how good their understanding is of medical terminology. But I would always explain to them, look, just because I say this right now doesn't mean you've got to be this way forever. It doesn't mean it's who you are. It just is what we're seeing at the moment. So let's talk about how to undo it. So that's an important point. Why is it important? Why do we care? Well, upper cross syndrome has several implications or ramifications in the physiological function of an athlete and a human. And here's the problem. If you're a human being in 2022, it is highly likely that you drive something for a living. And when I say drive something for a living, I mean you either drive a car or a desk, right? If you are at your desk most of the day and you are driving a keyboard, so to speak, you are already most likely cultivating upper cross in yourself. It's just a function of the ergonomics of most desks and staring at screens, or if you're on your phone a lot.
What's amazing is if you go out in the world, you go to the mall, you go to the gym, you go to the supermarket, once you understand what upper cross syndrome is, you will see it in almost
everywhere.
Everybody. It's yep. mind blowing how yep. common it is. And what I love about the conversation we're going to get further into here is that we're really honing in on the root cause of it being cycling. But when you think about it from a planet perspective, right? Like, a lot of people have it, upper cross syndrome, because like you said, they sit at their desk all day. A lot of people have it, they go to the gym because they only stare at the front half of their body and they never figure out how to engage that posterior chain. right?
Yep.
A lot of people have it because they spend way too much time on their phone, looking down with their phone in their hands, right? So there are so many root causes for upper cross syndrome. And it, like I said, after listening to this podcast, I challenge all of the listeners just to go out and just start pointing it out. And one of your best examples is ask yourself, are you walking through the grocery store looking like a bike racer? If you're looking fast in the cereal aisle, you've probably got some off bike corrective work to do, right? So Colby, why don't you tell us why people, cyclists in particular, should be really concerned about correcting this and fixing this? Why should they care?
Yeah, great question. I just want to emphasize one point to add on to our conversation before I get into the why we should care. And that is that I have really bad news for you. If you're sitting at a desk all day and you're driving a keyboard and you drive in a car a lot, or maybe both, maybe you drive to work and then you sit at a desk and then you drive home, or you're shuttling kids around or whatever you got going on, and you feel you probably have some upper cross, when you go to get on your bike at the end of the day or in the morning or at lunch, you're doubling down on the same posture. This is the bad news. Cycling multiplies upper cross syndrome tendencies. It spins them up because most people, when they go into that static hip hinge position and they reach for the bars, their shoulders automatically protract towards the bars. This is very common. And that also invites a rounding of the thoracic spine. And then, of course, because our torso is at a whatever 45 degree angle, we'll just say to pick a generic number, when they have to look up the road and they verticalize their face, they are creating the same chin forward posture and the shortening of the cervical curve in the back. So this is the curve of the backside of the neck. Those muscles get tight because they're supporting the weight of the head. And of course, you've got a helmet on when you're riding because you are a responsible cyclist. So that adds to the weight that the cervical muscles have to deal with. So why do we care? Well, there are lots of reasons why upper cross syndrome can impact our cycling performance as well as our general health, right? One of them is that for every inch we carry the head forward of the center line of where it should be, and to define that for a moment, when you're viewing someone from the side in ideal posture, if you dropped a plumb line from their ear, it would pass pretty close to between the center of the shoulder, pass down center of elbow, center of the hip, center of the knee, and just in front of the outside ankle bone, which is called your lateral malleolus, just pass just in front of that. So this would sort of be ideal weight distribution and posture. And when someone has forward head posture, their head comes out in front of that line. For every inch that happens, the weight of the head goes up by a dramatic percentage. So you are effectively increasing the load on those neck muscles, right? You're also potentially restricting your airway as you do that. So if you're sitting in your chair right now, wherever you are, maybe you're driving in your car, sit up nice and tall, close your mouth and take a nice deep breath and feel the air pass through your throat. And now extend your chin forward as far as you can and try to take a deep breath and tell me if your airway was the same, better or worse. There's a good chance it got worse. And a famous example of this is Chris Froome. People are always accusing him of staring at his power meter when he's climbing hard. But he's explained many times in interviews that actually he has a somewhat restricted airway. And the reason that he looks down is to keep his neck in neutral relative to his torso. So Chris is an example of a cyclist at the elite level who's figured out that when he cranes his neck into that Ichabod crane posture, he restricts his airway. So that's one potential problem. A second is that as our shoulders round forward, as our shoulder, think about the center of your shoulder or the glenohumeral joint, rolls forward towards the chest and you collapse, the shoulder becomes an unstable joint, right? This is easy to demonstrate. Go do some push-ups. Go do some pull-ups and try doing them with an anchored, stable shoulder where the shoulder is not, it's centered relative to the sternum, right? It's not, to use our cardinal directions, we're viewing our client from the side, it's not to the west, to the east, to the north, which would be raised up towards your ears, or towards the south, smashed down towards your hips. It's right in the middle where it should be. And of course, you'll find that push-ups or pull-ups or any activity that involves extension reflection of the arm will be easier when the shoulder is in that centered, stable position. So if you're riding on a gravel bike or a mountain bike, or even if you just like to go fast around corners on your road bike, do you want to drive the bike and support the weight of your torso with the bars in your hands with a stable shoulder that is protracted and rounded forward? Or would it be better to do it with a more neutral shoulder, which requires less muscular effort to keep the bike stable? And also, when you're on the edge of your handling ability, gives you an increased chance to take the bike, keep the bike upright. So here's another weird point about cycling is what is the objective of a time trialist? Well, one of them is to produce a lot of power, but the other is to be as aero as possible. And make no mistake about it, being aerodynamic on a bike is an act of contortionism, straight up. You have to teach your body to do really weird things. And one of the things that a good time trialist will do is they'll pull their shoulders up towards their ears and they'll roll them in towards the center of their chest, protraction and elevation of the shoulder joint. And this reduces the frontal area on the top side of the shoulder, which when your torso is horizontal becomes the front side of your torso. And it makes your frontal area smaller and it makes you really aerodynamic. But this is a disaster for posture. So if you're an elite time trialist and you're trying to win a national championship or maybe a state championship or maybe a world championship, understand that when you do that, you are compromising the stability of your shoulder. And that's fine for a time trial for 40 minutes. But you probably, in the interest of your general health, are tasked with undoing those postural accommodations by opening the shoulders and stretching pec minor and pec major, which become chronically short and tight. Right. And that's what pulls that shoulder into a protracted position. So the ramification ultimately is that you become potentially a crappier bike handler or a handler that's more at risk of dumping it if your shoulders aren't very strong. You don't have a good shoulder girdle that can stabilize the glenohumeral joint, that is the shoulder joint, where it should be. Then one implication of this postural syndrome is that you don't have that ability to drive the bike as effectively. One other really important aspect of an unstable shoulder joint is pulling on the bars. So anytime you're attacking a hill, a short climb, you're attacking the group out of a corner in a criterium or maybe over a little roller. You're standing up to stay on the wheel of someone who has just attacked. You've got to generate a lot of force by pulling on the bars to counteract all the force you're putting into the pedals with your legs and your hips. And if your shoulder joint is not stable, you can't do that effectively. So if we want to go into the gym and do, for example, a bent over row exercise, an exercise where you're standing on both feet, you've got your torso at 45 degrees, and you got dumbbells in each hand, and you're rowing that dumbbell, you're going to be far more effective at generating that force with a neutral shoulder, not with a protracted, weak shoulder that's in improper posture, right? And the same is true on the bike. People don't think of cycling as an upper body sport, and classically it's not, but the upper body definitely contributes to the amount of force you can drive into the pedals ultimately. And this is evidenced by the fact that almost every single key moment in a bike race, when someone attacks or when they win a race, it's almost always out of the saddle. It's very rare that people come to the line in the saddle. Only at the most ridiculous mountain stages do you see that happen. So what does that tell us? It means if you want to make maximum power and be a separator, you've got to get out of the saddle. In order to do that, you need a strong shoulder. Difficult. So to recap, the first point that we have is the forward head posture, which really could potentially restrict your airway when you're breathing on the bike, right? That's not true for all riders, but it's definitely a possibility. The second is the protracted shoulders, or the shoulders that are rolled in towards the center line, the front center line of your body. And this creates an unstable shoulder, which then can compromise your handling on the bike. The third point is that as the angle of the rib cage slopes forward when viewed from the front side of the body. So if you think of someone standing next to you and you look at them from the side view, like we were talking about, the entire rib cage starts to collapse on the front side and the spine gets longer on the backside. So the thoracic spine is in flexion. So what does that mean? Imagine you've just strapped on your heart rate monitor and you put it just below your pectoral muscles. And right where that heart rate monitor hits you in the back, this part of your back is rolled forward. It's extended. It's flexed. So it's rolled forward, it's collapsed. So when we collapse the front side of the torso and we elongate the back side of the torso, we prevent the lungs from fully inhaling. What is maximal optimal inhalation? It's when the diaphragm, which is like an umbrella shaped muscle right at the bottom of your rib cage, when that diaphragm pushes down, then the lungs can inflate with air. And ideally, the ribs all the way around your body, 360 degrees, get bigger, they expand. So when we have optimal inhalation, the ribs, this is called your vital capacity, grows. So the ribs will flare out in the front, and the ribs in the back of your body will flare out. And that can only happen optimally if your torso is straight. But when it's folded over in the front, you're folding over the diaphragm and you're preventing the bottom ribs from being able to expand out because you're crushed over them. So this is one of the biggest problems with upper cross syndrome, is it prevents proper inhalation. So obviously cycling is a sport where the vital capacity, the amount of oxygen you can bring in or atmosphere you can bring into your lungs, and then the CO2 you can expire is really, really important. It's a rate limiting factor potentially for some athletes. So we want to make sure you're breathing properly.
So the main takeaways here are unhealthy shoulders and restricted breathing. What's very common for cyclists who don't, especially those that don't do a lot of strength training, is are really immobile shoulders. Remember, before the first time I retired from cycling, I used to wake up actually in tears. I would have a frozen shoulder. And I didn't know what was going on. I grew up playing hockey. I was always very athletic. But when I just decided to double down on cycling and I didn't do any strength training for my upper body because I didn't know any better, my shoulders completely deteriorated on the bike. And it wasn't until, gosh, even a few months ago that I decided that I was like, man, you know, after going through retirement, going through strength and conditioning, working my whole life in the fitness industry, coming back to cycling, trying to do the pro cycling gambit again, realizing that all over again, I had developed this upper cross syndrome. And it took me, you know, stepping outside of like trying to be a pro cyclist, looking at my overall health, looking at my posture in the mirror, being like, dude, why are you standing like that? Like, it's so not only unattractive, right? It doesn't look good. It leads to all kinds of discomforts in your day-to-day life. Like, I'm sorry, but I love cycling, but I don't want to have neck pain every single day. I don't want to have an eye that twitches from tension from my traps that leads over top of my head and into my eyes, right? I don't want to have that. And I don't want to not be able to pick up really heavy grocery bags and walk into the house. You know, I want to be able to do these basic day-to-day things. I also want to look good when I put a nice shirt on, right? And so I think that cyclists, especially those who, I believe this is true for all cyclists, even professionals at the highest level, but especially for those who are doing this recreationally, we need to understand that the number one thing we fight against on the road is the wind, right? So we are constantly, as you said, you know, kind of wrapping ourselves around these bikes, just displaying some sort of contortionism, right? It's very, very natural to want to get aero, right? Mm-hmm. And it's okay to do that on the bike. But what we need to be very conscious of, and much more than other sports, you know, those who play tennis or do other sports, because as you said, you know, cycling is an extension of sitting in your desk chair, you know, promoting the development of this very terrible syndrome, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we need to take action to correct it, not only to, you know, be a better cyclist, but to live a healthier life overall. And so, Colby, what are your favorite techniques to help somebody overcome upper cross syndrome?
So we're really talking about a muscle length tension relationship imbalance. We're talking about a postural distortion. And in order to undo a postural distortion, simply put, we need to figure out which muscles are short and tight or hyperfacilitated and which muscles are long and weak or inhibited, right? And in upper cross, these muscles are pretty well known. So what we need to do is find a good stretch for the pec minor and pec major. These are the muscles that pull the shoulder into a protraction. So if you're stretching pec minor and pec major daily, that's one key stretch that is important. Another one is to stretch the neck extensors. So that's a stretch that would drop your chin towards your chest, right? Because upper cross is, of course, when the chin lifts away from the chest. So when we stretch the chin towards the chest and we really are tall, and we feel those neck extensors, those are the muscles on the backside of the neck, those need to be stretched, right? And then we need to also strengthen the muscles that are in opposition to those. So these are the muscles that pull the shoulders back. So we're talking about exercises like a prone cobra, where you lay on the floor and you lift your sternum off the floor and lift your chest away from the floor, your sternum away from the floor, and you're also pulling your shoulders down and back, right? This is a good exercise. We can also do reverse pec flies, for example, with light weight. That'd be a way to work the posterior chain in a way that opens the backside of the body, strengthens the backside of the body, and opens the front side of the body. These would be good examples of some of my favorites. I think the daily one for me is the pec stretch, pec minor stretch, and the prone cobra. These are essential postural corrections that I recommend for cyclists as a starting point, and the cervical flexor stretch, extensor.
So for me, I found a lot of benefit in the opposite. Of course, I've done all these exercises you're talking about. I think depending on your physiology, right, you might be somebody who does really well with the rear delt fly or these cobras you're talking about. I personally do better with things like the military shoulder press, right? Because the military shoulder press forces me to stabilize with the lat, right? Get that scapula engaged, get all three delts firing, and then extend all the way up through the motion. And so I found that so much of solving this rotational problem and pulling my shoulders forward problem, basically what we're talking about with upper cross, is just getting circulation in those areas, breaking down muscle fiber. And then the number one thing that I've realized that cycling does is it has a tendency to make a lot of these muscles get stuck together and they stop working independently. And so what I found when I go, and I'm not recommending anybody goes and lifts heavy with not a lot of experience in the gym, but when I go and I do a heavy set of older overhead shoulder presses, military presses, my whole upper body feels so much better. And I know cyclists have this, like, you know, this kind of stigma of if they go and they do any upper body at all, they're going to get huge. The world, most guys on the planet wish it worked that way, and it doesn't work that way. But, right. You know, you might be surprised at how much benefit you would feel if you did some of these corrective exercises or even some more compound exercises as a means of corrective measure to just balancing out all this, you know, kind of deconstructive things that we do on our bike, especially for our upper body. So you've got these exercises that you love to do. You've got these stretches that you love to do. Is there anything else that you would recommend to the listeners?
I'll comment on a couple of things you said there, Zach. I think, you know, for somebody who wants to get their muscles less glued together, right, but isn't comfortable or confident doing a really heavy lift like a military press, look, this is where myofascial release comes in. So you can get in there with some good foam rollers. There are all kinds of textured devices, balls, and different pear-shaped objects and stuff.
That's so right.
Yep. That's so right, one really good example.
Get into the subscap with that one.
Yep. That's a good one. Another one I recommend for my clients is called the Supernova.
What's that?
It's like a blue ball that's about the size of a grapefruit, and it's quite firm, and it's got a very specific texture that's sort of engineered in there to pull the fascia away from the muscle. That's a good one. So you can find lots of good tools. Don't be afraid to go into some of the nubbier, more textured tools, because the texture is what pulls the fascia away from the muscle. And ultimately, when the muscles are glued together, this is because the fascia is starting to form cross bridges and everything. So then muscles don't move independently, and the muscle doesn't glide through the fascial sheath. We want it to be free to glide. When everything's stuck together, then you get that sensation that you're talking about, Zach, where you just feel like your whole shoulder's moving as one unit and the muscles don't articulate individually. And this is the first step towards long-term Ichabod crane posture, the muscles start to get locked down and glued together. And if you leave that for a long enough period of time, you end up with frozen shoulder.
Yeah. So I think one way to put that is like, if you think about your body as like a job site, and our bodies as athletes are very much like construction sites, right? Well, what happens if the street sweeper doesn't come through to the job site and nobody's cleaning up the debris and there's no maintenance on the job site? Well, the houses don't get built, the building doesn't go up, nothing gets done. And so as athletes, so many of us have the tendency to just let the debris build up in the channels in between the muscles, all over the muscles and the myofascia, as you're talking about. We never clean it up. And so getting this work done, you know, if you have a massage therapist, that's that, like you said, great way to do it. If you don't have a massage therapist, these different tools we're talking about are essentials. And I think there's a misconception out there around these different tools where people want this like soft, spongy thing to like heal these different areas. And most times it's not the soft, spongy massage experience that you need to really get that release. And I think, you know, I'm interested to hear your take on it. But for me, when I go and I get real work done, it is not a relaxing experience. It's almost like a workout in itself.
I would agree. You know, how I think of it is, in order to get to really move the needle on the deep stuff, especially if you've been neglectful of your own myofascial release or your own debris cleanup for years, you're probably going to need some deep tissue work with a qualified massage therapist, and that will move the dial on the big stuff. There's some stuff you cannot do on your own. You need someone else to get in there and do it. And then the regular routine of myofascial release, using all the nubby balls and the rollers and the Sorites and all those great devices we have, that is a way to maintain things and keep things going on your own. So you don't have to go to the massage therapist every week, maybe, but you do need some periodic help. So I think there's a balance in those applications. Just like anything, though, you can overdo it. You shouldn't be doing myofascial release for 30 minutes or 60 minutes a day. I have clients who sometimes tell me they're doing this. This is too much. It is damaging to the muscles. So we want to do just enough damage to accomplish our goal, which is to free the muscle. And then you're done. It's minimum effective dose is the term I like to use for this type of work. Very important. It's essential work, but we're not there to hammer ourselves. It's not another to-do list. It's not another hour-long workout.
So we've got corrective exercise. We've got massage. And I'll add one more thing to that, and that is consciousness. Awareness of your body at all times. I think there's something that really bothers me when it comes to athletes, and it's that so many of them just go through the motions, and it's so contagious in cycling. We get caught up on FTP, going faster up climbs, segment times, this, all these different metrics, and we don't often enough check into how we feel. How are you feeling today? Are you out there with neck pain? Well, why? Well, let's check in. Let's make that a priority. Let's get our body into alignment. Why is your knee hurting? Right. Let's focus on fixing that. And if you get into the why and solving these different problems from all these different things that you have going on while you're out there riding, and you just chip away slowly at becoming somebody that just feels great all day, every day. And that's not just, you know, fitness and off bike work. It's also diet and all these different things that go into feeling and looking great and riding fast and just being awesome, dominating out there, right? But if you just start to chip away at these little problems and work on them, you are going to ride so much better. And that's ultimately what everybody on this listening to this podcast wants to do, is just ride faster on your bike. Is there anything else you want to add to it, Colby?
Yeah, say that was really well said, Zach. I think another way that I think about that is that people are so focused on what their best 20-minute power is, or 30-minute power, or 5-minute power, and they ask this question: okay, how is this prone cobra, or how is this myofascial release going to help improve my 20-minute power? And I would offer that this isn't really the right question, because it may or may not help your 20-minute power. Right? In some cases, it could. But in many cases, it probably won't directly. But there are so many other dimensions to you being a good cyclist that you need to think beyond 20-minute power. I would offer that when you can ride your bike consistently for 6 weeks without neck pain, and you can train hard every day, hard, not nuclear, but hard on the hard days and rest on the rest days, and you're looking after yourself and doing your myofascial release, that over time, that gives you a depth of fitness that is not measurable in a 20-minute FTP effort or 30-minute effort or whatever. It doesn't show up there. It shows up in repeatability. It shows up in 3 hours into a race when you make it through a corner where the guy in front of you crashed because he or she couldn't quite steer their bike through that loose sand and you just sailed right through it. And you've got the stable shoulder to do it. You've got the core to do it. So we're thinking a little less myopically about the immediate, how is this going to improve my 5-minute power? And how is this going to make my base broader? How can I build this house with a proper foundation? Clean the debris, build the foundation. Then you build a magnificent structure.
Well, I think what you just described is why we see some of the top riders in the world. Like if we look, for example, you know, Wout Van Aert. We see Wout Van Aert ride, and he looks beautiful on a bike. Yeah, just an absolute model for the sport, right? But that souplesse that you so often talk about, right? That perfect form, that execution of delivering the power to the pedals perfectly. This is an athlete who's doing all the right things, right? We did a podcast with TJ Van Gorder where he talks, you know, a lot about his passion for off bike work. And if he could go back into his pro career, that's the thing he would double down on is training in the gym. And so while to your point, right, you know, the Cobras might not directly increase your FTP, but will they allow you to get out there more on a more consistent basis? Maybe. Will focusing on all these little components of your overall health make you a better rider in the long term? Yeah, absolutely. And so when you see a guy or a woman in the Tour de France and they're on the top of their game, right? This is somebody whose entire focus is on being the fastest bike rider they can be. Now, for many of us, that's not an option, right? But we want to be the best cyclists that we can be in the amount of time that we're able to dedicate to the sport. And so for many of our clients and athletes and Team EF Coaching, it's like 8 hours a week. So some of these different things that we've laid out today can be done in 10 minutes. You know, it doesn't take much to go and do three sets of shoulder press or three sets of 12 Cobras on the ground, right? It doesn't take a lot to start getting better. But the first step is being aware of it. The second step is taking action. And then the third step is reaping the rewards of the work that you put in. And so I think if the listeners digest all these amazing pieces of information that you've demonstrated for everybody today, Colby, I think there's so much value in there. And if they start applying it, they're going to be feeling better, riding better, and going faster.
That's the plan. That's the goal. Help. I love to see it when clients, for me, maturity in the sport is about recognizing that, yeah, of course, most people get in cycling because they just love to ride their bike, right? We all love cycling. We're all bike dorks in our own ways. We all love to go ride up into the mountains and go flying down descents or go around corners fast or whatever it is that gets us excited. But for me, maturity in the sport is about recognizing that just riding my bike, while yes, it has some health benefits, it's not going to make me a holistically healthy human. It's not going to make me a healthy person if I only ride my bike. In fact, there's a point when it's going to start to cause me problems. So being mature in cycling is about recognizing, okay, I have enough passion for this sport that I'm also willing to do the off the bike work necessary to help me be a better cyclist. And then you have better alignment, you have better, you are pulled towards your goals instead of trying to force it by only riding and then forgetting, neglecting your body in other respects.
Well, I mean, if you want to be the best you can possibly be as a rider, right? Like you don't look at it as like a chore, right? You're excited. You understand that this is going to make you better overall. So you're like, okay, let me get that off bike work. You know what I mean? I can't wait to get into the gym or whatever, or get down in my basement or whatever. I just can't wait to do it because you know that it's going to help you. And I really appreciate those words, maturity in the sport, understanding that, you know, this is all about balance. This is all about doing things the right way. And one of the things that you said to me a couple of weeks ago that really stood out is that the longer people go down this rabbit hole of not cleaning up the debris in the streets, not taking care of their body, the harder it is to correct. And so this is something that we really want to encourage people to start doing on a daily basis, is address that upper cross syndrome, even if it's 5 minutes a day, 2 minutes a day, whatever you got. Start taking these little steps towards improving it. And if you would like some help with that, we have a team of very qualified coaches who are all supported by the wonderful Colby Pierce himself at Team EF Coaching. Feel free to schedule a consultation. We'd love to have a conversation with you about how we can be a part of your cycling journey and help you improve as a cyclist. Colby, that's all we have time for today. It was such a pleasure to have you on the show. You are amazing, such an asset to this team, such an asset to the cycling community. Thank you for your time today, sir.
Thank you so much, Zach. Your words are too kind, and I really appreciate what you do, and I appreciate you bringing the podcast to life. It's going to be great. I think it's going to be a powerful tool for our clients. So thanks for making the effort to do it, and thanks for inviting me on. Hopefully we can do more in the future.